It's time to listen to the interviews from Island Life on Saturday, the 20th of April, 2013. Island Life is our weekly magazine show focusing on Waiheke people, events and issues. It's brought to you every Saturday morning from 10 to 12 by the Humble Pie Village Butchery. You'll find them at 102 Ocean View Road, Oniroa. On Saturday, the 20th of April, Sharim Brown talked to retiring Te Herehi School Principal Ian Travers, Waiheke RSA President Bill Howling, and musician Ian Simpson.
Okay, so lovely. So you're listening to Island Life. I'm going to play an interview with Ian Travers that I did last week. He's had a whole couple of weeks of do's and entertainment and recognition, and it's quite lovely to see someone who's been so university popular, I think, is a good way of putting it. And you know, people at both events talked a lot about, you know, his leadership skills and his ability to listen and communicate. And yes, so he will be missed. But I understand that Mr. Sells is the new principal, and hopefully we'll get a chance to talk to him as well. But this is really for Mr. Travers as he leaves. So I'll just put that on now. Great. It sort of ends a bit abruptly because I got a bit sad at the end of that interview. Here we go. And that'll be the end of Island Life then. It'll be just about 12, and now I'm off to run around after children. So here we go. Hi, this is Sharin, and you're listening to Island Life. This is a pre-recorded interview with Mr. Ian Travers, who's been the school principal at Te Herehi for 25 years. Hi, Ian.
Good morning. Good morning.
So, well, you're actually leaving today, the day we're playing this, but we just wanted to get some of your thoughts on what it's like being a principal for this amount of time at Te Herehi and what it's been like in education. So, what made you stay as a principal for 25 years at Te Herehi?
Well, I guess when you come to a community like ours, it's a pretty exciting place to be, and not only an exciting place to be, but a beautiful place to be. So for Sheila and I, when we arrived here, we probably didn't intend to stay in those days, but it was an exciting prospect. The school was 450 students when we arrived, quickly rose to around about 630, 640. And then we found that there really weren't any bigger schools in New Zealand that warranted changing from such an idyllic place to live. So we stayed, certainly until the end of the first 10 years. And at that stage, we took a year on international exchange, teaching in Britain, which enabled us to really break our time at Te Herehi into two stages, which was really exciting, because those two stages represented in many ways a change in the community.
So England, teaching in England, that must have been very different from teaching here. I remember spending a bit of time in an English London primary school, and I was amazed that any teaching ever got done.
Well, I was naive enough to think to myself that you'd been a good teacher in the classroom, and you'd come to Waiheke, and all of those skills going back into the classroom for a year would be really easy to pull out. And I found it actually wasn't so. When I got into the classroom, it took me 2 to 3 months to find all those special skills that a teacher has. They were hidden in my back pocket, but they were just a bit further down than I thought, and took a little bit of time to pull out. And then it was an absolutely great year, and I was able to observe how schools manage their staff and manage their children, and which is really what I went for, to observe what principals do to teachers and to children, and what they shouldn't do. And that was really an interesting experience.
Was there any particular instances that you remember from that?
What it reinforced for me is that if you want success, everybody has to communicate well, everybody has to be on the same song sheet, everybody has to be committed to the same level of vision, really. And if they don't have that, then you get a disjointed effect, and children not quite knowing where they should be, what they should be doing, and very largely because the teachers don't know where they're at and what they should be doing. So it's important for any business, I think, that there's a very very clear vision and very clear philosophy about how you operate and how you work together.
Okay, so you mentioned that there was a change in education or the community. Was it the community between the time that you were here and then the time you came back? What kinds of changes were there?
Well, certainly in 88, when we arrived, Waiheke was just beginning to move away from being that very isolated community because, of course, the QuickCat had come on stream around about that time. Waiheke was being found, if you like, by the many in the city and around New Zealand. And Waiheke began to grow quite quickly, and many of the interesting identities that we used to know of on the island were around and added to the colour of the community. However, over that 10 year, that first 10 years, it seemed to me that those people gradually left. I guess we became a part of Auckland, and that change has continued to go on. There's no doubt about that, and I think in many respects, certainly this last 15 years that we've experienced here, Tuhurahi, Waiheke is really just a suburb of Auckland and a very different suburb. We all know that, but nonetheless, just a suburb of Auckland. And Tuhurahi, it's always been a great satisfaction to me that you could have taken Tuhurahi and put it in the middle of Auckland or in Remuera, and we would have held our heads as high as we do now, which is really exciting for me.
Not tremendous. So what have some of the key successes been in your eyes?
I think one of the most exciting changes that we've introduced in the school, led by Shona Byrne, was our deputy at the time, was Glass's model of quality schooling. And Glass's model of quality schooling is really a philosophy about how children learn, how we manage children, how children behave and why they behave the way they do, and how we work with children to improve the quality of not only their behaviour but of their learning. And we, over the years, introduced it. It was a highly complex set of ideas, but nonetheless, we had at one stage in a lecturer from the United States, and we had a week's training in our school on the William Glass philosophy. And that has proved to be probably the watershed in the school around about 15 years ago, probably a little bit longer, where children see their behaviour in exactly the way as they see learning to read or write, that is that you model the behaviour, you learn from your mistakes, you have opportunity to learn from your mistakes, you're not punished for getting things wrong, but you do learn from that. And of course, there's only so many times you can get something wrong, and the children know full well that after about the third time, if you're still making the same mistake, well, we perhaps have a different style of approach.
So is that the thing around the five C's? Is that where that comes in, or is that something different?
Yes, a number of years ago we changed the quality schooling model and the way we presented it, and led by Tess Parlane, our current deputy, we rewrote the Glass model or the quality schooling philosophy as the Tuhurahi way and the five C's. And probably we talk about the five C's of caring, commitment and so on, but around that is the bigger, and it's not a value, but the bigger concept of choice. And so we really have the five C's, but there's a giant C that goes around that, and that's the C of choice. And we talk to children about the fact that who's in charge of them, and only they are in charge of themselves, and the more skilled and knowledgeable they can be, the better choices they can make, and it's okay to get it wrong, but it's incumbent on all of us to be accountable for what we do and how we behave and how we manage ourselves, and the choices will always remain us. And for adults, it's exactly the same. It's exactly the same. We govern our lives by the choices we make, and sometimes we make good ones, and sometimes we make ones that don't turn out quite as well.
I have to say, for me, because my kids were in, you know, grew up, this is the primary school that they've attended, and it's been really enjoyable seeing that whole five C's philosophy and the kids coming home and talking about cooperation and commitment and courage and what are the other ones? Sometimes they don't know what they are, but they have a go. Caring, that's right, yes.
Caring sits at the top of the list for obvious reasons.
Lovely. And what's the fifth one then?
I'd have to look it up.
Right, yeah. Yes. Okay. Anyway, commitment. Oh, yes, they love commitment. And is that a philosophy that's shared by other schools?
The Glasser model or the Glasser philosophy is worldwide. And in many respects, most schools have some sort of process like that or some sort of thinking. It seems to me that a number of schools haven't actually thought out what underpins what they do. And I think that the exciting thing about the Glasser model is that all the time we're able to refer back to how we behave as adults, how as teachers we work with children, because the Glasser thinking or the quality school thinking is as much to do for teachers and the adults that work in a school as it is for the children. So the rules, if you like, of behaviour are the same for everybody. There's no room for me to be shouting at somebody. There's no room for me to be hitting somebody. That would be a problem, of course. But we talk to children about how we all behave. So it's really incumbent on parents and teachers to model the behaviour they expect and to be accountable. And I think perhaps if I have a thought about where things go wrong, I have that deep suspicion that for some parents, not making their children accountable for some of the bad decisions they make sets them on a road that they as parents and the children have great difficulty with, because the rules are not clear, the boundaries are not clear, and all of us live in a society where there are boundaries.
Yes, I couldn't agree more. But I also think that parents now struggle with what it means to set boundaries, and that, you know, how you can be kind to your children but at the same time have boundaries and make it clear to them that there are, you know, consequences or certain behaviours are wrong. And I often see parents struggling with that. Yeah. But the other thing is, you know, my kids went to Fiji for a while and they missed the school, and what they talked about was the five C's. So it's very much ingrained in you know, their experience of school.
I think bringing up children for all of us as parents, and Tudor and I are parents, obviously, and if we had arguments earlier on in our married life, it was probably to do with our own children and what should happen and what should be the right strategy. And I think that dialogue for some parents is difficult. I think that some mums and dads have great difficulty agreeing on the strategy that they should be using with their children. And I guess that comes back to what I was saying earlier, is that if you have a clear philosophy and a clear strategy about what you expect, and I think mums and dads just have to get together and work out what that is, and then they have to stick to it, and schools have to do the same. They have to be clear about what they want, and then they have to make sure that everybody sticks to it and everybody's consistent. I remember as a child, if I wanted something, I would ask Dad, and if Dad said no, then I would go to Mum, and I'd work on who was going to be the weakest link in the chain until I finally got the answer I wanted. Children are no different today, and that's why I think that parents have got to get together, they've got to sort out what it is that they want for their children, and then they've got to stick to it. But most of all, they've got to make their children accountable for those things that they do that are not acceptable.
Absolutely. And maybe you could go into marriage counselling next, because I have to say, I think that's the reason I broke up with my ex-partner.
Relationships are certainly extremely difficult, and relationships are of course what makes things work. And when we talk about the five C's for the children, it's really about what is the oil that makes that work. And I think it's really important that if somebody is doing something for you, if another child's helping you in the classroom, you say thank you, or you say please, may I have your rubber, and so on. Those are little things that make life tick and smooth waters. And And it's important to say thank you, and it's important to say please, and quite often those things are easily lost for young people.
That's right, and that's courtesy.
And that's courtesy.
The fifth C. Right, good. And, okay, so what have been some of the challenges that you've had at the school, or in terms of managing an educational establishment and keeping fees down year after year, which you seem to do quite successfully?
Well, I think all businesses, all homes, every single one of us are challenged financially. That's just the reality, because I think our aspirations about what we would like to have or what we would like to do or where we would like to go always is greater than the capacity to do it in terms of the money that we earn. So somewhere along the line, you actually got to decide what it is that you want. When I look back and think about the building of the school hall, what a fantastic combination of ideas and people who just really bought into the vision and got out there and did all the things necessary, whether it was applying to the ASB Trust or whether it was running a cake stall or whatever it may be, that commitment brought people together, and we were able to manage ourselves very, very well. The school started in 86 or 85, 86, and the school had very, very little. So it was quite some years before I felt we were strong enough in the resources that we have for us to be able to take on a major project like that. But it comes back to everybody being clear about what it is that you want and everybody buying into the idea. And I think what's now starting in relation to the swimming pool, and how can we improve that, and how can we come together as a community to drive that so we have an improved facility for everybody on the island. I think it's those sorts of things that are important. And, of course, it's one of the reasons that Sheila and I have enjoyed being in small communities. Somehow or other, drawing the community together and working with people is much easier than the big city.
And certainly that swimming pool project is a great example of sharing facilities that are the school's facilities with the community.
Well, we've had a board of trustees, fabulous boards of trustees in the time that I've been here, who are committed to making sure that the resources that we've got are resources used by everybody. And I think that's expansive thinking. I think that's thinking that is identifying the need for learning rather than the need for our children. And it's not our children, it's the children who are, or the young people who are on the island. And you see it in so many ways, the various groups and organisations, the sports clubs and so on, Sea Scouts, you name it. There are a group of people there trying to identify a need and support young people and make our community that much richer. Fantastic.
No, tremendous. Now, you've been a principal and a teacher, and you've seen lots of changes to education and lots of changes of government. What are some of the key challenges you see now for education, or some of the key successes that you see in education at the moment?
Well, it's been a 46-year career for both Sheila and I, and Sheila's done 43 years, and I've been a principal for 32 years and a deputy principal for 10 years. So somehow or other, leading schools or working in schools and that sort of capacity has really been our life, which has taken us to a range of communities in the country. And over that time, it seems to me that the strength of the community and the ability to identify the visions about what they want is what drives things. It seems also to me that governments often get in the way. And currently we seem to have some thinking that says, let's worry ourselves about whether children can compute their times table in 4 minutes or 3 minutes or whatever, when in fact New Zealand's in the recent publication just two nights ago in the Herald demonstrated that New Zealand's 15-year-olds are achieving fourth highest in the world. Now, we don't have those sorts of achievements unless we have a good quality education system, which we do. However, having said that, anything can be improved. And somehow or other, governments, because they're in there for a short time, like to be able to say, look, we can show statistics that we've improved this or that and so on. And that's shaky ground, because the reality is that communities, schools and parents know that what's really important for their children is quality learning, but an all-encompassing environment for their children, not just being good at maths and reading and writing, but also being good at music, being good at sport, being able to relate to one another on the playground, being able to participate in a group, and the list goes on. And the exciting thing for me is that Kiwi kids are well received wherever they go overseas, because they arrive overseas saying, we can do anything. And they believe in themselves, they believe they can do everything, anything and everything, because they've been through an education system and a culture in New Zealand that says we can get in the bush and we can fire a gun, or we can hang our own wallpaper, or we can build our own fence, or we can lay our own concrete pathway. And while it's good to have a professional to help support you do those things, nonetheless, Kiwis just believe all those things are within the realms of what they can do. And so that means that you've got interested people who are young people who are out there excited about what they're doing, challenged by what's going on. And my son going to England for the first time, getting a job as a travel agent, not a travel agent, but a leader in a travel group, and taking his first tour to Edinburgh and telling people how exciting it was and how wonderful it was, and never having been to Edinburgh in his life before, just told me that he was able to talk, he was able to feel confident, he was able to take on whatever challenge was thrown at him. And that's what we want from young people. We don't want just the simplicity of reading and writing. We need to be skilled at that as well, but it's a broader learning environment.
And do you think that's perhaps being eroded, or there's less emphasis on that than there was? I mean, what I notice is there seems to be increasing pressure on teachers not to perhaps be as creative or teaching as much, but more of a focus on assessment. But maybe that's just an illusion. I don't really know that much about primary school teaching.
I suspect that with a recession, and I've seen it before in a recession, governments become more conservative, people become more conservative because they're protecting their environment, and that's a natural enough reaction. In that process, what happens is that people can become much more, it seems to me, simplistic about what are the right things and what are the wrong things, and we start ticking boxes. And what sadly I think is happening is that there seems to be a lack of trust in teachers in many professions. We highlight the errors, we highlight the 5% where it's gone wrong, and we forget, and of course newspapers tend to do this for us, we forget that for 90% of young people working in school and teachers, that everybody's in there beavering away every day and doing the best they possibly can with the resources they have. And I think we very easily slip into talking about the wrong rather than the vast majority, which is the right. And there are many, many exciting things happening in education. We have to be extremely cautious that teachers work closely with parents, and we have to make sure that teachers, communities, and parents work together. And if we are unhappy with what the politicians think is important, then we should be getting out there and saying so. And that happened in Christchurch, and quite rightly so. We have to be very, very careful. We don't allow politicians to straitjacket our curriculum and focus on just a few things, when in fact we know as parents that we want an all-encompassing environment and learning environment for our children. And we need to stick to that. We need to continue to do what we do well, and we need to continue to work on improving it. And I'm excited by the way I think education's going in terms of e-learning, and there are some wonderful, wonderful opportunities in that environment. And school for young people is no longer 9 till 3. It's 24 hours a day. It's every time they pick up their computer. It's every time they talk to somebody. Going to school is part of the social interaction around that. But learning is broadening, expanding, extremely exciting.
It is quite exciting, isn't it? I just noticed with my kids the access they've got to information now, and they can research anything they want on the internet. It's quite exciting. I do worry sometimes that you know, there's a risk that there's a corporatization of education by involving computers too much, and a risk of the government perceiving that maybe it would be a cheap way of getting rid of teachers. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I think there's a need for a great deal of experimentation. Because learning's about relationships, not a relationship with a computer, but about relationships between students, between their parents, between other organisations they belong to and so on, I don't think the computers will ever take over education. I think that, if anything, classes should probably get smaller so that children are guided in how they use this new environment. And we need to make sure that young people learn the skills and the techniques of managing the social media, of managing the enormous amount of information that's out there. The sum of all knowledge is exponentially growing at the rate of, or doubling in the rate of every 3 to 5 years, there is simply no way that anybody can know anything and everything. They have to have the capacity, the skills and the tools to be able to find what they need to find. But more importantly, I think that they need to have the sense of values to underpin how they manage that. So we don't want to say to young people, you should never go on this site or that site, or use this wrong word or use that wrong word, because those concepts keep changing. And words that my parents said were absolutely unacceptable, in many cases are now quite acceptable. And young people need to be able to have a sense of identity and values in the way they use the social media or the media and e-learning, so that when they look at something that's not acceptable, they make a judgment that says, that's not acceptable, I need to move away from that. So, and those are the values that we need to teach young people.
And that's certainly really exciting in some of the work that's been done at Tahurahi, isn't it? That's sort of those pseudo sort of Facebook sites that kids can experiment with and are supervised in doing so. It's quite interesting that the media isn't transparent, but we're actually helping them to use the media.
Exactly. I think that for young people, the concept of what they put on their Facebook site or whatever it may be right now will be with them forever. It's simply nonsense. There's no way you can ask a 10-year-old to understand that particular concept. But in fact, that's what's going to be happening. And young people today and young adults are discovering that something that they wrote 2 years and 3 years ago is coming back to bite them. And we need to teach young people about those sorts of things. And if we can do them in a safe environment within a school environment, such as our alternet, then we can teach them how to use those two sentences to make a statement, to be precise about how they write, to be clear about how they think, and to be concerned about how they talk about other people. And I think those are things that they can learn at school. And again, it comes back to those choices they make and the sense of values that they have. These are fundamental to the way people function and operate. And yes, we two times two is still four, I think. But I guess some mathematician could prove
not much changes.
Well, some mathematician could prove it probably isn't. But in terms of values and so on, those are far more fundamental concepts that people need to understand and learn about. We need to empathise with other people around us, and we need to empty out our jails, because we don't have people behaving in the way some of those people are, because we've given them the tools and the skills to be able to manage their life in a way that is important and allows them to be good citizens, if you like, whatever that concept may be.
So moving away from technology in the future, you started out your career in quite a rural environment. And so what was that like, being a teacher who was in a community who'd come in from outside, where the schools have more than just a responsibility towards the kids in the school. Where were you working, by the way?
Well, but Sheila's English. She's from Yorkshire and came to the high school environment, and we both met at training college, and we trained, and I was teaching at an intermediate in Lower Hutt, and she was teaching in the in Upper Hutt. And of course in our second year it was the 10th of May and the Wahine storm, and so that was our first, that was my biggest classroom lesson, where I had 300 for music in the hall because most of the teachers didn't arrive at school, and we were left with all these children and just a few of us to manage, and the police came and took children away as the day progressed and so on. So there are exciting things that stand out in your career, and from there we were off to our first my first deputy principal role in a place called Taranaki, Kāponga and Taranaki, and dairy in the dairy companies and dairy farms, and there we were literally, if you like, taken in by the community and farmers, and we were so well treated and so well looked after that our 3.5 years in that environment, I guess, cemented our view that strong small communities have a sense of values, have a sense of interest in their schools, are committed to their children, and that's exciting. And for Sheila and I, we have a passion about children's learning and the excitement they get from that. And there's nothing more exciting than seeing that burst of understanding on a child's face when they finally get it. So from there, we were off to the Uruweras, to a two-teacher school in the valleys behind the Uruweras, and I remember attending my first school committee meeting, and halfway through the meeting stopped, and they moved into the Horse and Dog Trial Association meeting, and suddenly I found that I was the secretary of the Horse and Dog Trial Association, not knowing anything about horse and dogs, but apparently I could write, and therefore we were sucked into the same sort of environment, and it was just fantastic. There is such strength and identity in many of our farming communities that's what they survive by. They survive by drawing on the strength and the support of others, and the school was just wonderful. It was just a wonderful place to be. It had its swimming pool, its 2 tennis courts, its 4 acres for the teacher to run his experimental farm. I won't tell you about that. And then from there we were at years in Tokoroa, which was the largest Cook Island community outside Auckland. So that was another experience. And then to Reparaa, which was another dairy farming area. And my brother said to me, "You must go to Auckland. That's where it all happens." And I wasn't too sure about that. However, at that point, we were successful in winning the position at Tuhurahi. And, the rest is history, really.
Mm. Oh, interesting. So Tuhurahi stopped you in your tracks, so to speak.
Well, I guess it did, and that wasn't what we intended to happen, but again, where can you go that's as beautiful as Waiheke? Which leads us, I guess, really to saying, where to next? So for us, for Sheila and I, teaching in small communities and the environment has been our life. We've just moved from community to community in that respect. And Tuhurahi, it was the same. And now the next move is really just more of the next adventure. So for Sheila and I, we've drawn great support from one another. We've revelled in the people that we work with. And perhaps the one thing I haven't mentioned is the stunning group of teachers that I've... It's been our... luck to work with, if you like. Such committed people, and as the principal of the school, I have to say my job's been relatively easy because of the quality of the people that I've had the joy to work with. So from there it's on to Tauranga or Bethlehem, because I'm not sure I can say this, but Jerusalem wouldn't have us, so Bethlehem's the next spot, and we have a 5-year-old and a 7-year-old grandson down in Tauranga, and then a couple of months in overseas, because we have a son, Bryce, who's in England with a 6-year-old, and that will be all part of the next adventure, I guess.
Well, it all sounds tremendously exciting. And yes, yay to Hurahi teachers. And also to...
You're listening to Waiheke Radio, 88.3 and 107.4 FM.
I'm here with Bill Howling, who's the president of the RSA, and he's been president of the RSA for the last 10 years. And it's the 20th anniversary of the RSA having their premises in Ostend. So, hi, Bill.
Hello.
And so tell us how that came to be, that you got your own premises.
Oh, well, as you know, the RSA... was officially opened in May the 28th 1993. It was opened by our then past president Doug Stewart, but the RSA had been going for many years before, in name only, of course, as it was never, we never had a building on our own. And I joined in the club about 1991. And at that time, we used to meet in different venues around the around the island, which is places such as Spray's Edge, what eventually became McGinty's, and is now the Sands down the end of Onitangi Strait there, and the bowling club and the Buff's Lodge, and also the golf club. Then we had a change of president, a guy called Doug Williams. He became the driving force behind the club actually being built. And around about that time, we had about $20,000 to $30,000 in the bank. But we applied for a grant from Lotto, which we've got, and which is around $60,000 we got there, and also a grant from ASB was $10,000, and some of our members volunteered to give us debentures or produce debentures for the club, and eventually we got the club up and building and make a start on building the club. And we also had a lot of help from our members, of course. We had a lot of our members used to come every day and work alongside the builder. And they got their nickname of Charlie's Angels, which was nicknamed after one of our members, Charlie Quinsel. He was our vice president at the time. And so in between us all, we got the club up and running and got the club built, And it's become sort of a club we're very proud of, because I feel it's become a sort of, not just a club, but I think a very, one of the best, if not the best, social and community organisations on the island, for the way our members react with the club and support the club and get treated by the club.
So, and you've got great events on as well, haven't you?
Oh, God, yeah. Well, within the club, there's so much going on with so many subsections within the club, and sort of the women's section plays a very big part in the club, and we've got fishing sections, darts sections, card sections, line dancing sections, so there's a lot going
so
on.
So how do you... what's the prerequisite for joining?
Well, now, none at all, really. It used to be years ago, you had to be a service member to join the RSA, which is different now, and anybody can join. So you just walk into the RSA, fill in an application form, $20, and you become an instant member. So
lovely. And then you can join all these different clubs.
Once you become part of the club, and I say now we're doing pretty good now. We've got a membership of nearly 1,100 members. For this time of year, it's brilliant. And we get usually we have our committee meetings every every month we an average of about 20 to 30 new members every month joining. So
wow.
So it's looking really good.
So does it appeal to a particular demographic? Does it tend to be slightly older members of the society, or is it all different ages?
Now it is. Yeah, we're getting quite a lot of younger members joining the club, which is good, you know. We need them, you know. And plus the associate members, you know, if anybody can join there, which they class as associate members. Yeah, so we've got all age groups now, you know, younger ones. And
So when did that change, that you no longer had to have a kind of an association of being in a return service?
That goes back quite a long time. Many years ago, yeah. It sort of changed over years. That was sort of during wartime, I started, you know, during about wartime, and then it was very strict in the entire. You couldn't even join the RSA if you were a serviceman in New Zealand.
Oh, really?
You had to be
a return serviceman.
Oh,
right. So it wasn't available to people who just stayed locally and helped with the war
days. Not them days.
War effort.
Because it's changed over the years, which you can sort of, a lot of the service people are dropping off, and so you need your associate members to keep your club going. You know?
Interesting. You still have that kind of... you still sort of manage the whole Anzac Day celebrations, don't you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the RSA is very important. Yeah, that's the basis of the club, you know, and it sets your rules, your standards and your traditions, you know, and that's very important, you know. You never want to lose them, you know, because that's what makes the club what it is. You know, it's a place where people can come in comfort and safety, you know. We got a lot of single women, you know, would come to the RSA where they'd never go to sort of other sort of places, you know, because they feel... ease and comfort in the club, you know.
Okay, interesting. Oh, good. So what do the women's section do then? What are they up to?
They do lots for the club, especially like yesterday, which was Poppy Day, you know. They help out with the selling of poppies around the island, you know. And Anzac Day, they're big help, you know. We've been sort of... with the breakfast, with the dawn parade, and they get involved in that, you know. And they do a lot of, you know, different things within the arts. They organise the travel clubs and the car sections and housey sections, you know. They're all involved in things like that, you know. So
It sounds amazing. And of course you can get a nosh up there as well.
Food is brilliant. Yeah, we've got a very good cook with Sherry in our kitchen, you know.
Good. So what's happening for Anzac Day?
Oh, well, Anzac Day. Well, dawn parade, obviously, 6 o'clock in the morning, so, you know, and it's getting bigger and bigger every year.
Hopefully I'll make it this year. The number of times, I think I've tried twice, and the best I've got is getting there about 6:25, and people are, like, pulling away,
And that's to say, that's the dawn parade, which is a very short parade, you know, and lasts about a quarter of an hour. But it's sort of quite an emotional sort of. And it's, you know. And then, of course, we've got the civic parade, which is at 11 o'clock. And then that's, you know, hundreds and hundreds of people. It's brilliant, you know, it's a brilliant day.
Yes. For some reason, scouts like to come to the very early one. I don't get it.
But they do. We get a lot of support from the younger kids, and the support. Sea Scouts and guides, and they come to the dawn parade. You know, it's great. You know, and of course at the civic parade as well, they get involved in the march. It's only a short march, but it's involved in everything of the day. It's a great day, you know. So
lots of fun.
All the service personnel, the Navy, the Army, and the Air Force guys who come down and so on.
So do you still have a lot of people who have actually seen active service anywhere?
We've got there's a couple of guys that are from the Second World War, but we've also got Vietnam guys and guys who served in Korea and different other places, you know. So
I know my ex-partner was quite excited. He'd probably be your youngest member, actually. Who's seen active service, because he's he was in the Israeli army.
Oh, no. You're talking about now. Aaron.
Aaron.
Because I live just across the road from where you
were. Right, okay. So, I've often seen you walking up and down that road. Yeah, well, I don't live there anymore, but yeah.
No.
Oh, right. Good. Okay, so Dawn Parade, 6 o'clock?
6 o'clock. 5.30 for 6 o'clock. Yeah.
Oh, 5.30. Oh, God, it gets worse, doesn't it?
You're on parade, on parade at 6 o'clock. Yeah.
Right, okay. Oh,
and
dear.
After that, you know, the people who come to the Dawn Parade, they get the breakfast afterwards.
Oh, good. Yes, well, that's certainly compensation.
If you like your rum and coffee, if you like that.
Oh,
that,
right, okay. Oh, wow. Yes. Well, now it's starting to look a bit more...
It's a good start on the day.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Oh, that'll be a cheerful day. Yeah. And so, and then the other one is at 11 o'clock.
Civic Pride is 11 o'clock.
Okay, yeah. So 10:30 for an 11 o'clock start. And then the other thing is, and it's just great to hear, you know, about the membership and how anyone can join and,
it's a good club, and, you know, I can't recommend it enough, you know. So I've been with it a long time, but it is a place, because it's a place, it's a good atmosphere, a good camaraderie in the club, you know. Also, you know, because there's so many people in the club, get involved in the club, you know, and they're doing their bit to sort of make it a good place, you know.
Absolutely. And also you manage to give some money away to charity as well, don't you, sometimes?
Yeah. Well, we do. We do have to give. We give a lot. So we've sort of... organisations on the island, you know, because we've got the poking machines, and a certain amount of that has to go to charities as well, you know. And being an incorporated society ourselves, you know, we're entitled to use it as well, you know. So, but because the RSA is a non profit making organisation, you know, so but no, we do, you know, give quite a lot, you know, sort of throughout the year.
Lovely. Great. Yeah. Well, thank you very much. You said you needed to go for a ferry. You've got 20 minutes to make
the
ferry.
No, it's cancelled now. So
you cancelled. So you've got, okay, lovely, good. Okay, well, thanks very much.
No,
that
thank
was great.
You. Yeah.
Wakey Radio.
Now, we've got Ian here, Ian Simpson, who's... have you got a stage name?
Ian Simpson.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
Well, that could be confusing to some.
I tried a few, but none of them really fit.
Right.
Monkey was one, but that didn't really work.
Right, okay, excellent. Anyway, so Ian's in today talking about a fundraiser and music and New Zealand Music Month. How's it going?
Good. It's going good. Yes, New Zealand Music Month in May. So a couple of years ago, we did a big theatre show, which was... called the Acoustic Cafe, and there was one, so we had some that ran for about 18 months in one of the cafes in Ostend, which is no longer there. So we did a big gig where local musicians and people from Auckland came over to play all original music, and it was great, and, you know, it was sold out. So we're doing another one of those, and it was related to the Steiner homeschool group. Used to be part of the Fossil Bay community, and now it's sort of branched out by itself. So, yeah, we're fundraising for that.
Lovely. So tell us what's going to be happening then at this event.
Well, the other one, we had about six acts. I got rather carried away on this one, and we ended up with 10 acts. Nine local acts, original acts, a couple of people that I haven't seen play on the island before. And a number of people that have played quite a lot on the island too. So I'm quite looking forward to that. And then there's also going to be a group coming over from town called the 2AM Orchestra, who I think had a number 2 on the Kiwi charts a wee while ago. So, yeah, interesting little group. Looking forward to hearing them.
Lovely. So what kind of, what kind of things have stood out for you in these 10 acts? What kind of music is it?
Originality is the key. When we were doing things with the Acoustic Cafe at the cafe, in the cafe in Ostend, it was always trying to recreate a performance cafe atmosphere. So we used to have poets and that kind of thing, but it ended up just being music. So a lot of it was acoustic acts, but certainly not exclusively. And one of the bands that be playing, which is a local band called Oiwa, who I believe may be in for a session quite soon this weekend in the radio, and they're going to blast off a few tunes at the end of the night to bring it all home.
Lovely. Okay, do you know whose show they're coming on?
I don't know. Okay. I believe they're doing a live session, maybe with Ramon.
Right, lovely. And they're a local band?
They are, yes. Okay. People like, I won't mention the names, protect the innocent.
Yeah, okay, excellent. And
So they're a relatively newly formed band.
Well,
but
they're
some musicians that have been around for a bit.
They've been in various bands on the island. I mean, it's basically people like Nicky Nartai, Miles Gillette.
Right.
So they've very active musically on the island. So yeah, the band that they have currently. Well, they actually played at the Fossil Bay Fair, the annual fair there, and did a rather nice job too.
Yeah, no, it's good. So are some of those acts going to be playing again? Some of the other ones from the Fossil Bay.
Aaron Carpenter.
Lovely.
Will be coming down, and I think this is with so many acts, they're just going to be playing just a small handful of songs each. People like Frankie Hill, who has a long pedigree, I believe, in music, and goes back to like Flying Nun days and stuff. So it's great to see her coming and doing a solo set. And Soul Sister Mel on the island, JB James, and a lady called Marnie Jane Harris as well, who's I think recording an album at the moment. She actually has been living on the island very secretively.
Great. So do they feel like there are more more people on the island musically
I could have kept
than
going
there were or not
there are lots of people on the island, and original music is very very abundant. There's just not that many original music shows happening anymore. That Acoustic Cafe monthly event doesn't run anymore, but I was talking to another lady who just came to the island, an Irish singer-songwriter called Aideen, and she came down. I was playing at Malone's in Surfdale last night, and she came down and played a few original songs before that as well. There's just heaps of people.
Wow. Because that's really what's special, isn't it, to hear original music. I mean, you can listen to the same old on the radio all the time. So it's really great when you can hear
and to be in a
writing their own stuff and having an opportunity to perform it for a live audience
and
not being massively out of pocket for having, you know,
true
the effort.
Yeah, it is a labour of love, but also to be able to play in a sort of environment where people actually do listen, because that, you know, it tends to be either with the live music, it's either covers or it's original music, and you have to kind of do one or the other. So it's good to have an event which people came expecting to hear original music and actually tuned in and listened. That's invaluable to, I think, performer.
Mm. So when is this event?
It's on May the 11th, May in New Zealand Music Month, and so it's going to, music starts at 7 p.m. and we're selling tickets hard out at the moment. The last one actually sold out. We had 120 tickets sold out before the night, which is awesome, so we're aiming for something like that again.
Great, and where is it?
It's going to be, it's at Artworks Theatre, and the tickets are $20 prepaid, so people can book through the theatre. And or they can contact me somehow if you know where I am.
Well, you can get down to the market in about half an hour. You'll be down there.
Oh,
well,
I've got my eldest boys down there now, selling tickets as we speak.
Excellent,
hopefully.
Great.
He wasn't mucked off with all the money.
yeah, exactly. You can spend the next week looking for him.
That's right. $20.
Pleading with the ice cream vendors to give you the money back. Yeah. Great. Good. Okay. And so Acoustic Cafe, are we going to get that back?
Interestingly enough, I was talking to someone last night. I'm not particularly thinking it's having the right venue, the actual the Nourish Cafe who supported it, and that's what it needs. It needs, you know, someone needs to actually support it, and it's, you know, it costs, it's effort. That particular show, we used to get people over from Auckland, so, you know, there's ferry cost, there's the time, you know, a lot of people give it as a labour of love and for the opportunity to play to an interested audience, but still, you know, it needs a bit of energy in that way. So who knows, it's possible. There's certainly someone else who's on the island who's wanting to do something at the moment. It's not something I'm looking to carry by myself, but yeah, if the demand is there, you never know, it may happen.
That's always the trick, isn't it, when you're interested in performing and you've, you know, that's what you want to do, but then there's the whole organisational side of things, which actually is like a massive job,
and
someone needs to take on board.
Yeah, that's
and
right.
Often that, I mean, yeah, it's done as a labour of love, but it's not really a sort of a, you know, anything that's artistically connected, and it's just grind, isn't it?
That's true.
Making sure people turn up and working out how people are going to get paid and...
Yeah, well, if you see me down Malone's on Friday night, I'm certainly not necessarily, although I did play a few originals last night, and certainly not what the public necessarily wants that is there anyway. So, you know, yes, it is, depends on the venue, depends on the people, what they're into. So I guess that's it, really. It's just finding the right space to do it in, but it doesn't seem to be any obvious space. But
Gulf Sound and Vision, no? On the
well, that's where we used to, that's where we used to do it, when it was Nourish Cafe. That's right, free CD or something. For
Yeah. The other one was the Solar Cafe. I don't know if that's a venue that's coming up a bit, because it's got that area in the back.
A few people have mentioned it. Golf Club got mentioned once upon a time.
I mean, there are venues. It's just like you say, someone's got to take it on board and
yeah, that's right. And you know, I mean, I'm a musician and amongst other things as well. But so, you know, when I created that acoustic cafe originally, and because that's what I wanted to see happen on the island. But when a lot of your energy gets drawn into organisation and driving around putting posters up and that kind of thing, then it kind of pulls you away from something else that you want to be doing.
Exactly. Yeah. Absolutely. Okay. Great. And so we can get it's May the 11th. May the 11th. Lovely. And other things that you have been drawn to for New Zealand Music Month? Other events that you've seen?
The library.
The library's doing lots of stuff. I haven't seen what they're doing specifically.
I know there's a lady there called Ella Rose, who I met today at the market for the first time. She's actually, she's got a trio called the Southern Lights, who are actually playing on the 11th at the theatre show, at Acoustic Cafe show. I know she's involved, and I'm actually going to do a slot at the end of May. I think the last one they're doing in May. Can't quite remember the date now, but Saturday mornings or Saturday something.
Saturday. And that's always, that's a great use of the library, I always think.
Yeah, it's cool. Yeah. I think we did live to air it last time. I remember you doing an interview with us after I did it with Andy Lewis, the mandolin player.
Yes. Is he going to be doing it with you again?
Oh, quite possibly. Yeah. He's big in the library.
Ah, lovely. Yeah. He's well connected in the library.
Oh, yes.
There's no stopping him. Yeah. Okay, great. Okay, well, thanks so much for coming in.
Cool.
And sell lots of tickets. And I'll try and come along. It sounds amazing.
Yeah. Thanks for the invite to come around today.
Okay, no worries. See ya.
Cheers.
Okay.
You've been listening to the Interviews from Island Life, our weekly look at Waiheke people, events and issues, every Saturday morning from 10 till 12, with interviews repeated on Wednesdays at 7 p.m. and Thursdays at 12:30 p.m. Island Life is brought to you by The Village Butchery, the place to go for great cuts of meat and friendly service. You'll find them at 102 Ocean View Road, Onirua.